Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Breaking news from earlier today, Michigan Attorney General's office drops all pending Flint water crisis criminal cases pending further investigation. The Michigan Attorney General's office announced today that they have dismissed all pending criminal cases connected to the Flint water crisis that were brought by the former Office of Special Counsel. It is important to note that the cases are being dropped without prejudice and that charges could be brought against the defendants again. What does this mean going forward? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. She's a civil rights attorney and partner at the law firm Goodman, Hurwitz, and James. Her firm is part of the Flint Water Class Action Legal Team trying to get relief for the people of Flint, Michigan. Julie Hurwitz. Julie, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
We had you on April 2nd to discuss former Governor Rick Snyder once again becoming a defendant in the class action lawsuit against the state from the Flint water crisis. Today, the Attorney General's office drops all pending Flint water crisis criminal cases pending further investigation. What does this mean to you and to your clients?
Well, it's a very interesting question. The interplay between the criminal prosecutions and the civil rights, civil damages actions, it's very convoluted and complicated, but how we view the decision that was made by the Attorney General's office today is simply that the struggle continues. Our fight for justice has not ended. We believe that this new Attorney General, Dana Nessel, does have a much more sincere motivation to try to do the right thing to achieve justice in Flint. And I think that comes through in the press release that was issued from her office this afternoon, in which she acknowledges, or their office acknowledges, that despite the decision that they're making, they recognize that this occurrence in Flint was the worst man-made environmental disaster in the history of this country. And we are looking at this not as an ending, but as a fresh start. While we were glad to see the former attorney general initiate criminal prosecution against many of the wrongdoers in Flint back in 2015-2016, we also did see how he was being motivated almost entirely by his own political aspirations, This guy Bill Schuette. Mm-hmm. And so there was nothing trustworthy about his efforts and about his motives. So the way in which they handled the prosecution up till the election of Dana Nessel, our new attorney general, has always kind of stunk and has been very poorly handled. So we are encouraged by the steps that are being taken here. We believe that the net will now be much wider and much stronger.
Okay.
We believe that the new attorney general believes that there are more people much closer to the top of the chain of command who are culpable for this disaster. And I do emphasize, this was not a crisis. This was a disaster. A crisis sort of suggests that it has a beginning and an end. Mm. And this is an ongoing travesty that has yet to be resolved for the people of Flint and for the people of the state of Michigan.
So if I understand the distinction, the Attorney General's office announced that it's dismissing the criminal cases. Your class action legal team has been on the civil side.
We have been, yes.
So does this suspend your case?
Oh, not at all.
Okay, what does this do to the case of the Flint water class action legal team?
if it does anything at all, it actually opens the door now for us to obtain more discovery, more evidence. Because when you have a criminal charge pending against you, you have the right under the Fifth Amendment not to make any statements or disclose any evidence that might be incriminating to you.
Now that's been taken off the table.
Well, arguably, it has been taken off the table. That's correct.
Okay. So now then, that Fifth Amendment protection of the right against self-incrimination doesn't apply. So now you can ask deeper, more probing questions, and the Fifth Amendment defense will not, should not apply in this case.
That would be the position we take. Mm-hmm. Now, on the flip side, of course, they can continue to argue that, well, the AG has made very clear that their purpose for dismissing these charges without prejudice is to begin a much more intensive and much more focused investigation of criminal culpability. And so they can argue that even though these charges were dismissed, they were dismissed without prejudice, so those individuals are still looking at the potential for criminal prosecution, and therefore they continue to assert their Fifth Amendment rights, which they could try to do, and they may be able to. So it'll be a battle of how to interpret the scope of the Fifth Amendment protection in a case like this.
I want to read a bit from Attorney General Dana Nessel's statement. Nessel says, "The depth and breadth of concern for a fair and just prosecution and justice for the people of Flint is precisely why I appointed and entrusted Solicitor General Fadwa Hamoud and Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy to lead the Flint criminal cases. I trust them, and if this step is necessary for them to do a comprehensive and complete investigation, I am in absolute support. I want to remind the people of Flint that justice delayed is not always justice denied, and a fearless and dedicated team of career prosecutors and investigators are hard at work to ensure those who harmed you are held accountable." And you, if I can inject some words into what you've said, you don't see this as political fluff. You see this as an honest assessment from the Attorney General.
I'm cautiously agreeing with you.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, you're an attorney, so I understand that.
I want to believe that that's true.
Okay.
And knowing Dana Nessel's reputation and how she is approaching her job, I believe that she is making a genuine statement.
Okay. And Hamoud and Worthy issued a statement saying, "It is important to note that this voluntary dismissal by our team is not a determination of any defendant's criminal responsibility. We are not precluded from refiling charges against the defendants listed below or adding new charges and additional defendants." You find that to be substantive?
Well, I find that to be extremely significant.
Okay.
And when they say adding new charges and additional defendants,
that's encouraging.
And I think if you move further down into that same statement, they acknowledge that this is something that will not, you know, bring immediate remedy or relief to the citizens of Flint. They say, "Our team will move forward unrestrained by political motivations, prior tactics, or opportunities for financial gain." I think that all of those factors were at work and have
okay.
been at work
okay.
throughout this entire ordeal on the criminal prosecution end of things. And most recently, of course, is the disclosure that Governor Snyder's telephone had actually been in the custody of the state attorney general's office for we don't even know how long.
Mm-hmm.
And the criminal prosecutors who are now working on the case just obtained knowledge of that and are now
okay.
in the process of reviewing and analyzing I don't know how much
okay.
data that had been extracted from his phone. So that's going to, I think that's one small example, but pretty significant example
gotcha.
Of what kind of funny business might have been going on under the helm of the previous group of prosecutors appointed and hired by Schuette.
Well, let me say, Julie Hurwitz, civil rights attorney and partner at the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, you are part of the Flint Water Class Action legal team. Thank you for joining us today on such short notice with this breaking news, and we look forward to having you back.
Thank you. If I could just say one thing in closing, you know, whatever is happening on the criminal prosecution end of things, we are still fighting vigorously to force the state of Michigan to come to their senses and provide some form of compensatory relief to those who have been struggling very, very, under very difficult circumstances, trying to survive in this city without safe drinking water. So the struggle continues, and I thank you so much for having me.
Oh, Julie, thank you for joining us. The pleasure and the thanks is all on this end. Thank you again, and again, look forward to having you back.
Thanks again. My pleasure.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. UK Home Secretary signs Julian Assange extradition warrant. The UK Home Secretary has signed an extradition warrant allowing WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange to be extradited to the U.S., where he faces charges of conspiring to hack government computers and violating espionage law. This is reported by the Financial Times, but it is a bit confusing. Sajid Javid announced today that he had formally agreed to the request, which was received from the U.S. Justice Department this week. He, Assange, is rightly behind bars, Mr. Javid told the BBC. Quote, there is an extradition request from the U.S. that is before the courts tomorrow, but yesterday, Wednesday, I signed the extradition order and certified it, and that will be going in front of the courts tomorrow. What does this mean for Julian Assange and the process in London? For insight into this, we turn to our next guest. He's a political analyst, commentator, and editor of The Polemicist, and his latest op-ed is entitled Swedish Sex Pistol Aimed at Assange, Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Leon.
So help me understand this. The Financial Times reports Westminster Magistrates Court will hold an administrative hearing into Assange's case tomorrow, Friday, but has not yet set a date for a full extradition hearing, which could take place later this year. The court will decide whether the case meets the legal test for Assange to be extradited to the U.S. It will not decide whether he is guilty or innocent of the U.S. allegations. So what does it mean that the U.S. Home Secretary has signed an extradition warrant, as reported by the Financial Times, allowing WikiLeaks founder Assange to be extradited?
I think it's just the beginning of the process. I think his signature today is kind of a formal recognition that there is a valid extradition order from the United States, or extradition request from the United States, that the Home Secretary, the UK Home Secretary, acknowledges and accepts this extradition request from the United States. But that's just the beginning of the process that will then go to the courts. So really what's going to start happening in the courts starting tomorrow is whether is going to be the contestation of this extradition request and the UK government's acceptance of it. And that's going to take, there are a number of steps that go through this, the district court and then the high court and then finally Supreme Court. And it can go all the way up, and this is going to go on for some more months. Now the British have to resolve this with 40 weeks left in his detention for bail jumping. But this is just the beginning of a process. It's the formal beginning of an extradition process, I think.
A Home Office spokesman said today that Assange had been arrested in relation to a provisional extradition request from the United States relating to offenses including computer misuse and unauthorized disclosure of national defense information. The spokesman added, "We have received the full extradition request, which has been certified by the Home Secretary. The case is now before the courts, and it would be inappropriate to comment further. So, to your point, they're acknowledging that all of the formalities are now in place, signed by the proper British officials, the Home Secretary, and now they proceed as charged.
They proceed to the court challenges to that. And it's interesting that they did say he was arrested in relation to an extradition request because, no, he was arrested in relation to the bail jumping.
Right.
And the extradition request, it's interesting if they are acknowledging that they really arrested him in relation to the extradition request because their position has been they arrested him in relation to the bail jumping. And they had to get, and that's why they brought him into custody. So, but it substantively doesn't make any difference. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens tomorrow. First of all, whether Julian Assange is well enough to attend the court hearing tomorrow. It's going to be a significant event to see, to determine whether that's the case or not. We saw the interview with his father. I don't know if you saw that. They interviewed his father outside the prison. It was a moving interview with, you know, his father talking about the state that he's in. So that's number one. What's his state? What's his physical and mental state? And what can he participate in his own defense? And now you're going to see the legal challenges start to emerge in a very specific way in terms of pleadings and motions. And, you know, this is not over. It's just beginning. What's also interesting is the fact that the further down the road this goes, now that the British have acknowledged and accepted this extradition request from the United States, it gets increasingly harder for Sweden to pop in and say, we have an extradition request that has to take precedence. The longer this process goes on with the American extradition request, that gambit, which I talked about in my last article, gets a little harder to play, although I don't think it's out of play yet. I think we'd be silly to think it's not in the background and can pop up at some point. But this is another interesting aspect of this.
The UN warned last month that Assange would be exposed to a real risk of serious violations of his human rights if extradited to the U.S. Niles Melzer, the UN special rapporteur on torture, accused Washington and other democratic governments of ganging up on Assange and called for him to be given greater access to his legal team. So it will also be very interesting to see as international opinion weighs in and weighs in heavier on this process, if that will have an impact on the proceedings in London and the perspective of those in London.
Yes, this is very important because the UK government in its statement to the Ecuadorian government about how the process of extradition would work in the UK made the statement very clearly that they had answered the question, what must the court consider in extradition proceedings? And the things that would work in favor of barring the extradition would be one of them would be whether the extradition would be incompatible with the, I'm quoting now from the UK government, whether the extradition would be incompatible with the requested person's human rights. So that the UN is saying it would be is a position now that Assange's lawyers can take. The other thing they said, I'm quoting again from the UK document, extraneous considerations, whether the request is made for the purpose of prosecuting someone on account of their race, religion, political opinions, or sexual orientation. So Assange's lawyers are going to argue on the basis of these UK law, these UK exceptions, that this is a matter of political opinion, and given using the evidence of the human rights, of the UN statements, that it's going to subject him to human rights violations.
And which is interesting that a Home Office spokesman laid out offenses including computer misuse and the unauthorized disclosure of national defense information as though the Home Office spokesman is trying to lay the predicate or trying to diffuse the human rights argument.
That's right. And we have to remember that the UK has an Official Secrets Act. That, you know, the things that would be legal and accepted and have been, like in the Ellsberg case, publishers publishing classified secret information, not just whether stealing it, but publishing it, is in the UK illegal. So the United States government can make the argument that we're not charging them with anything that wouldn't be illegal in UK. See, right. That's one of the things that's going to be important, and it's going to be a position and arguments of the U.S. government.
Jim Kavanaugh, as always, thank you for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to having you back, because we know that this one is not going away anytime soon.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Jim. All right, folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Memphis police on high alert after shooting leads to protests. Police were called to assist U.S. Marshals after a suspect was fatally shot in the Frazier neighborhood. Law enforcement officials in Memphis, Tennessee, were on high alert following a clash between police and protesters last night after U.S. Marshals fatally shot a suspect. The suspect, who was identified as Brandon Weber, Shelby County Commissioner Tammy Sawyer said on Wednesday. She said he was shot 16 to 20 times in his family's front yard. Memphis Mayor Jim Strickland said that 6 officers were taken to the hospital and 2 journalists were injured. What does this tell us about race relations still going forward? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's an American scientist and the Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Biological Studies at the Joint School for Nanoscience and Nanoengineering, which is jointly administered by North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University, or North Carolina A&T, and the UNC Greensboro, Dr. Joseph Graves. Joseph, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me again.
Your thoughts when you first heard and read about this story?
Well, my first thoughts are having to do with 16 to 20 times.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be some kind of rationale for why a suspect has to be shot to begin with. And then, of course, why it was necessary to shoot the suspect 16 to 20 times. So not having been on the scene, not knowing, you know, whether the suspect, you know, had a weapon or was responsible for, you know, killing someone or doing some other serious crime before these events, you know, it's hard to know. But the 16 to 20 times just jumps out at you, because there's been too many times in the past when police violence against individuals of African descent seemed to be disproportionate compared to the circumstances. Of course, the most famous case of that was the shooting of Amadou Diallo in New York, when the individual was reaching for his wallet and was shot 44 times by a group of police officers that had basically been put together for the sole purposes of terrorizing the African American community. So again, without details, in Memphis, this just seems to be out of sorts. It doesn't seem to make any sense with regard to the necessary use of force with regard to apprehending a suspect.
The Texas Bureau of Investigation stated that marshals approached the victim, who was wanted for multiple warrants, as he was getting into a car. When marshals tried to stop him, he reportedly rammed his vehicle into the officers multiple times before exiting with a weapon. The officers fired, striking and killing him. Now, here's something that I find interesting, according to ABC News. Authorities have not provided details about the charges that prompted the task force's interest in him, but a criminal history on him was released, and this is what we find, that there were 2 arrests, one April 2017 and one April 2018, on charges including weapons possession, drug dealing, and driving without a license. Court records show the 2018 charges were not prosecuted and the 2017 charges were dismissed. His father, Sonny Weber, told the AP that his son had been planning to return to the University of Memphis in August and that he was the father of 2 children with 1 on the way. That, to me, is interesting insight. What say you, Dr. Joseph Graves?
Well, again, you know, this seems from everything that I'm hearing, a disproportionate use of force with regard to taking down a suspect. Again, I don't know how many officers were on the site, but it seems that if, you know, there was a weapon, and again, they didn't say what kind of weapon, whether it was a firearm, whether it was a knife, whether it was,
or an edge weapon, right?
Yeah, you know, we don't know what kind of weapon it was, but I mean, unless this person is a superhero, it doesn't take 16 to 20 shots to take somebody down.
Now, here's an interesting commentary. Quote, every time a young man is shot by law enforcement, the community mourns, and it's a constant reminder of the mistrust the Black community has for police. That, according to Tennessee State Representative London Lamar, he told The Root, we don't know the facts yet, but there are many people in Memphis hurting. And I think that speaks to the larger national mindset and speaks volumes to the unfortunate relationship between the African-American community and police/policing across this country. Your thoughts, sir?
We have to look at what the institution of police have been for African-Americans. So, you know, if you look at the mantra protected serve, which sort of describes the way it works for the European-American community throughout our history, that's just not the way it's ever been for African-Americans. It's more been to suppress African-Americans, to control them, and to take away any sense of freedom for the African-American community. You know, we're now living in what sociologists are calling the era of mass incarceration. But mass incarceration also goes with it, you know, a constant police force in the African-American community with the goal of controlling our population. So, you know, this is something that needs to be fixed in the context of the way our society operates. You know, we can, in one hand, claim to be the bastion of freedom, but have the largest percentage of individuals incarcerated in the world. And I think now even the largest number of persons incarcerated, which is amazing when you consider the size of nations like India and China that have far more people but have far fewer absolute numbers of people incarcerated and a much smaller percentage of their population incarcerated. So, and of course, in the United States, those rates of incarceration are wildly disproportionate, with African-Americans being incarcerated at a rate of 7.1 times that of European-Americans and yet not committing 7.1 times the amount of crime. So we have, on one hand, a culture of mass incarceration, a culture of police in the African-American community as a controlling force, not protecting that community, and a police force which, in virtually every case in which it is deployed in the African-American community, is not made up of proportional numbers relative to the African-American community. So it's persons of European descent in the main in the African-American community controlling the African-American community. And this is something that has to stop.
Dr. Joseph Graves, as always, thank you for your insight. Thank you for your analysis and your contribution to the Critical Hour. I look forward to having you back. And I guarantee, I promise you, the next time we call you, we're going to call you about a whole different topic that is more in line with your research and your study. How about that?
I would just like for you to call me on something that's actually uplifting and good.
Well, and that's what we're going to do.
I'd be happy to do that.
Dr. Joseph Graves, man, thank you for your time.
Thank you for calling.
All right. Folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Tankers attacked in Gulf of Oman, U.S. Navy says. Two petrochemical tankers in the Gulf of Oman came under suspected attack early today amid soaring tensions between the United States and Iran. One of the two ships attacked, a Japanese-owned tanker, was targeted just as Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was wrapping up a high-stakes visit to Tehran to help cool hostilities in the region to commemorate the 90th year of Iranian-Japan relations and potentially mediate U.S.-Iran talks. It was hit twice over a period of 3 hours this morning, company president Yutaka Katada told reporters in Tokyo. How much of this should we question, and how much of this should we take on face value? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Daniel, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
So let me start with the question that I just posed. How much of this should we question, and how much should we take on face value?
Well, I mean, apparently, I've seen the photographs, the incident occurred. I think it's highly unlikely that Iran did it. I mean, Iran is hosting the Japanese prime minister. It wants to marshal world opinion to its side in its dispute with the United States. And this is the last thing it would want to do, is since this will alienate world opinion, it's just about the last thing it would want to do or one could imagine it doing. So I think it's extremely unlikely that it's Iran's fault. And I think that even more to the point that since these tankers are apparently carrying Japanese products bound for the Japanese market, that it's probably somebody with an anti-Japanese, anti-Iranian agenda who is behind this provocative act.
So is this amateur hour at the CIA or Israel Secret Services, or is this, to your point, continue with your thought about, you know, because they're talking about, oh, well, this could be Iranian-backed actors like Hezbollah or somebody else, or is this totally off the grid in that regard?
No, it's the Middle East, so therefore there are a whole long line of possible possible actors who could do something like this, but the least likely are Iran or one of Iran's allies, because this goes completely counter to any kind of Iranian agenda, which is looking to wage a propaganda offensive against the U.S. and against those who are trying to isolate it on the world, on the world scene. So this, the last thing Iran wants to do is provoke any kind of is engage in a provocative act, which will alienate world support, as this certainly would. On the other hand, there are a lot of people in the Middle East who are happy to strike out at Iran and at Japan as well for making making friendly noises in Iran's direction. There's a whole long list: the Saudis, the UAE, Al Qaeda. One could go on and on. But it's, I just think Iran is the least likely suspect.
So let's shift it from who it could be, the list that you just articulated, and the list might not change based upon the answer to this next question, to who has the real capability. Because some of the reports I heard is that it was a missile that struck the ship. Some of the reports that I've heard, the ship was struck by a landmine. I've heard a number of different scenarios here throughout the day. So if we narrow the list, not from whose interests are being served to who would have the capability of carrying out the attack, does that shift your analysis in any way?
Well, a little bit. I mean, Al-Qaeda probably does not have any seagoing missiles or floating mines. I presume not. But certainly Saudi Arabia does, and certainly the UAE does. So therefore, those are certainly possibilities. And of course, Israel has capability as well. But Israel would not. I can't imagine that Israel would engage in anything so flamboyantly provocative.
Why do you say that? And I ask that not to disagree with you, but I find that to be a very interesting statement, so I'd like for you to elaborate.
Well, if they're found out, it'll be disastrous for Israel. I mean, if Israel is found out engaging in caught engaging in a kind of false flag attack, it'll look awful. It'll be embarrassed. It'll be compromised on the world stage. It'll be like a gigantic exploding cigar in its face. but the UAE, the Saudis, this is their backyard. So it's entirely feasible that they would engage in this kind of act. And the Saudis, of course, are incredibly clumsy, incredibly inept when it comes to these kinds of maneuvers. So I guess they would be up there as suspect number one. I can't be sure though. But the point is that Pompeo, for entirely political reasons, is pointing the finger at the least likely suspect.
You're taking me to my next point, which is, Pompeo said in a statement this afternoon that intelligence showed Iran was responsible for the attacks and that the United States would be raising the matter at the UN Security Council. A U.S. defense official who spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe an evolving U.S. response said military officials assessed that the attacks were carried out by Iran or forces under its influence. He said officials think the attacks were conducted by divers using limpet bombs, but did not say how that conclusion was reached.
Oh, I really can't respond to that without getting in trouble with the FCC. But let me just say that Pompeo, the whole Pompeo Trump line, Pompeo-Bolton-Trump line, is that Iran is the main source of terrorism, of violence in the Middle East, and that is standing reality completely on its head. Completely on its head. And this is just another part of their slander campaign and their attempt to drum up war. And the terrible thing is that sooner or later, they will be successful. I mean, sooner or later, a war is going to erupt in that part of the world due to their efforts. And it's going to happen probably sooner or later, I would guess. Sooner rather than later, I would guess.
A little earlier today, according to CNN, U.S. Navy spotted an unexploded mine attached to one of the attacked ships. The crew of the USS Bainbridge reported that they saw an unexploded limpet mine on the side of one of the ships attacked today, according to a U.S. defense official familiar with the matter. Limpet mines were also suspected to be used in the May attack on four oil tankers off the coast of the UAE. So one thing you got to love about them, they stick to the bit.
Yeah, but Iran is the least likely to have done this. I mean, they have everything to lose and nothing to gain. Absolutely nothing.
I was hearing earlier and reading stories earlier that part of the Iranian Navy was helping to assist some of the sailors that were on the ships and took them to an Iranian island for safety. But now I'm having trouble finding those stories.
I mean, look, the Iranian regime is just as problematic as any other regime in that highly problematic region. But the point is that they are the least likely suspect because they have the most to lose from this kind of incident. And the U.S. is playing the bully. It's strutting down the sidewalk, shoving people into the street. And sooner or later, that's going to lead to trouble. Now, the whole Pompeo-Bolton clique is doing their best to create a war in the Middle East, and they will succeed sooner or later. And this could very, very possibly be the incident that triggers the outbreak. But if it happens, by the way, if a war does break out, I mean, it's going to be a doozy. It's going to drag in the entire region. It'll stretch from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean. It's going to be a very, very bad thing. And yet the U.S. and its recklessness, and by making reckless charges like the one that Pompeo is making, seems to be doing its best to bring on the conflagration, and that's just insane.
What does it say to you that Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has gone to Iran to try and act as an emissary, as well as you have Qatar, who Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani in Qatar is warning that U.S.-Iran stalemate could trigger conflict. So there seem to be a number of cooler, saner minds that are trying to intervene in the process and calm the rough seas, while you have others that are trying to escalate the tension.
Well, listen, there's only a small knot of nations that is trying to provoke a confrontation. That's the U.S., Israel, the Saudis, and the United Arab Emirates. The rest of the world is appalled at the way things are playing out. The JCPOA, the nuclear accord that the U.S. entered into with Iran in 2015, Iran was upholding its part of the bargain. It was playing by the rules. I mean, it was behaving in an honorable, law-abiding manner. And it's only the Trump administration, which has taken its bat and ball and gone home, which is breaking the rules, breaking the accord for no good reason, and doing its best to promote a confrontation. Now, Trump behaves in a provocative, bullying manner against very weak countries because he thinks they can't strike back. So it's easy to bully a Venezuela or a Mexico, for example. But Iran's a different story. Iran has allies throughout the region. And if a war does break out, it'll be a massive conflict. As I said, that will stretch from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean. And it'll be the worst war that's broken out in the Middle East to date, which is saying a hell of a lot, right?
Two things I'd like for you to respond to. One is Pompeo saying that the United States is going to take this to the UN Security Council. So my first question to that point is the U.S. risking a rebuff by the Security Council the same way that they tried to take the Venezuela story to the Security Council and China and Russia stepped in and said, no, we're not voting on this. We're not buying this. And then before you answer that, let me read that there was also a Norwegian-owned ship that was hit as well. The tanker called the Front Altair was carrying some flammable petrochemical products. It was struck. The ship's 23 crew members, 11 Russians, 11 Filipinos, and one Georgian, were rescued by a nearby vessel and transferred to an Iranian ship, then taken to the Iranian port of Bandar Abbas. So I did find a story that says that the Iranians did step in and assist with the rescue. But my question to you about Pompeo saying they want to take this to the Security Council, are they risking another embarrassing rebuff by the Security Council the same way they suffered one with this whole Venezuela scam?
Of course they are. They're virtually guaranteed of a rebuff. I mean, Russia and China will never go along with this. They're walking into a buzzsaw. But the U.S. doesn't always listen to the U.N. or the Security Council, and the U.S. may retaliate for some reasons or retaliate against a false target. The Saudis or the UAE may succeed in pumping this up even further. I mean, there are a lot of forces that are pushing for the U.S. to go to war. I mean, as I said, the Saudis would be happy to fight the Iranians to the last American. So there are a lot of forces pushing for war, and the U.S. has so far shown every sign of going along, and it's going to be just a horrendous. It's going to be horrendous if this thing really blows up.
Final question to your point about going to war, understanding that President Trump is a very, very transactional individual, that he seems to engage in action, all things are one-offs. Is there a larger strategy here, or is this just reckless bullying behavior in order to sell more weapons around the world?
Well, the answer is both. I mean, Trump himself is erratic. He's inconsistent. He's volatile. He'll say one thing one moment and the opposite the next. But however, Pompeo and Bolton have been consistent forces for military confrontation, whereas Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been even more forceful in that regard.
My question there is, though, to what end? There's no win here. As I call it, smoking at the gas station. When you light that match, the whole damn thing blows up.
I totally agree. It's just completely nihilistic. I mean, the U.S. has pumped in literally trillions of dollars of weapons into that region. It's a powder keg, an absolute powder keg, and the U.S. has done everything in its power to make it worse. And Israel might reap some momentary advantage in Lebanon or Syria, I presume, if a war does break out. That's possible. But the Saudis will suffer terribly. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if the Saudi regime didn't collapse in the event of an actual war breaking out.
Really?
Well, I've been saying this for a long time. I think the Saudi regime is very unstable, very weak, very unstable, and that that a serious storm could cause it to capsize.
Hmm.
I mean, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, is completely isolated. He's conducting a reign of terror. The whole country is frozen in fear. But it could take, you know, it's just one bullet is all that's required to knock him off. And if that does happen, there will not be a smooth transition, but rather the country will collapse in chaos. And Saudi Arabia as the next failed state, I would think that would just terrify foreign policy strategists in the U.S. But the American foreign policy establishment is so nihilistic, so short-sighted, that they may be blundering into a catastrophe.
Well, there's a lot more for us to uncover, particularly when we look at the relationship between MBS, Prince Mohammed Bonesaw, and his mentor, Mohammed bin Zayed,
right,
from Abu Dhabi. Would like to get into more of that, but we're going to have to do that another time.
Sounds good.
Let me say, as always, thank you so much for your time. Greatly, greatly appreciate it and look forward to having you back.
Great. Thank you.
All right, folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is a fabulous piece in Mint Press News by my next guest. It is entitled, How Neocon Billionaire Paul Singer is Driving the Outsourcing of U.S. Tech Jobs to Israel. And it is written by the fabulous independent journalist Whitney Webb, and she joins us to discuss this piece. Whitney, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Let me read your first paragraph. With nearly 6 million Americans unemployed and regular bouts of layoffs in the U.S. tech industry, major American tech companies like Google, Microsoft, and the Intel Corporation are nonetheless moving key operations, billions in investments, and thousands of jobs to Israel, a trend that has largely escaped media attention or concern from even America First politicians. The fact that this massive transfer of investment and jobs has been so overlooked is particularly striking, given that it is largely the work of a single leading neoconservative Republican donor who has given millions of dollars to President Donald Trump. With that, I will throw to you.
Well, so the neoconservative billionaire I'm talking about there is none other than hedge fund billionaire Paul Singer. I call him a neoconservative billionaire because for decades, he has been a top funder of many of the most controversial neoconservative think tanks in the United States. These include the American Enterprise Institute, where John Bolton used to be employed, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, known for its hawkish stance on Iran, among others. He's also a top donor to Marco Rubio and other neoconservative politicians. So what's happening here is that I talk about, it's also important to mention as well, that in addition to being a donor to Trump, he's also a donor to the Likud party in Israel and to the current Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, which makes this particularly interesting because he was inspired by a book that was published in 2009 by an employee of Singer, Dan Senor, who is a neoconservative as well and has previously partnered with other neoconservatives such as Bill Kristol and Robert Kagan to fund the Foreign Policy Initiative, which was also funded by Singer. Singer was inspired by a book written by Senor and a Jerusalem Post journalist that described Israel as the startup nation and talked about what it described as Israel's economic miracle having to do with its tech industry. And it describes Israel's tech success and its growing role as a cyber power due to its military conscription and its liberal immigration laws, which is interesting when you consider Trump's policies here. So it's basically a heavy promotion specifically of one unit, the Israeli military intelligence unit known as Unit 8200, which is sort of like the NSA of Israel. It's where Israeli hackers work. That organization, as an example, was responsible for the Stuxnet virus, among other things. And so what Singer has done is he's basically created this organization that was inspired by this book. It's called Startup Nation Central. And this organization has deep ties not just to the U.S. government through IPAC, because IPAC's longtime director in Jerusalem, Wendy Singer, who's actually Dan Senor's sister, is executive director. It's also run by Benjamin Netanyahu's former economic advisor. Its general manager is a man who is a longtime executive at Amdocs, and Amdocs is an Israeli telecommunications company that was flagged in the early 2000s for aggressive espionage against the U.S. government. So these are the people involved in creating this tech transfer, and this organization that's funded by Singer and was founded by Singer describes itself as a foreign ministry for Israel's tech industry aimed at strengthening the Israeli economy, and was also founded explicitly to counter the BDS movement, or the Boycott, Divest, and Sanctions movement, by making Israel's tech and tech sector so globally important that it would become impossible, essentially, to boycott Israel. And this is actually a plan that Netanyahu has voiced in recent years and claimed that it was his deliberate policy to do this, which is interesting given Paul Singer's connections to all of this, that Netanyahu wanted to make it impossible to boycott Israel by doing exactly this, making Israel global cyber power, which is, you know, currently being done, as I mentioned in my piece, at the expense of American jobs and at the expense of the American economy. And another part of this plan that Singer has been, through this organization, has been actually promoting, that has also been promoted by Netanyahu, is putting top people in this Unit 8200, this Israeli NSA, into top positions in U.S. tech companies. And these include Google, Facebook, and Microsoft. And in my piece, I detail some of the numbers here, that there are several top executives that are former Israeli military intelligence officials in these companies, and how this is actually really troubling when you consider that a lot of these companies are major U.S. government or U.S. military contractors, or do contracts for the U.S. intelligence community, things like that. And given Israel's history of espionage in the United States, you know, let's remember too that leaked Snowden docs name Israel as the third most aggressive spy agency targeting U.S. government agencies in the world, behind China and Russia only. You know, there's a lot to be concerned about here.
You know, your point about installing individuals into a lot of these companies as a way of offsetting the BDS movement, it reminds me of Richard Nixon's attempt and successful attempt at putting operatives above and beyond the executive service level in this country and implanting these people as managers and directors on the civil service side. So even right after the Nixon administration goes away, he's put operatives at the management level on the civil service side to really implement and carry out the agenda long after those in charge are gone.
So that's definitely a real possibility to consider, especially considering that a lot of these people that are former Unit 8200 movements, they are in charge of major operations of tech companies. So, for example, Let's go with Microsoft as an example. The head of their research and development center is a former member of Unit 8200, for example. Their lead managers for engineering product strategy, threat analytics, and also cloud business intelligence. Let's remember, too, that Microsoft is about to win the cloud computing contract for the entire Pentagon, and its entire cloud operations, all its cloud products are based now in Israel, with the chief executives in charge of that program are part of Israel's NSA equivalent. I think that's really troubling, and that hasn't apparently been a concern to the Pentagon at all when considering Microsoft for this contract, which I think should be a red flag here.
You also write, and we just have about a minute and a half left, to make matters worse, many of these top tech companies shifting investment in jobs to Israel at record rates continue to collect sizable U.S. government subsidies for their operations while they move critical aspects of their business abroad, continue to lay off thousands of American workers, and struggle to house their growing company branches in Israel. And it's important to say that embedded in this article, you have links to other pieces and documentation to support the allegations that you make here.
Absolutely. I do indeed. And so another example, let's continue with Microsoft as the example. In the past 4 years, they've laid off over 20,000 employees, many of them Americans. At the same time, they've been on a hiring spree in Israel. They're building new campuses. They're leasing office space because they can't house all their new workers. They're investing billions of dollars annually in its Israel-based research and development center, not its U.S. research and development center, notably. And it's also pumping millions of dollars annually into Israeli universities and institutes, not in the U.S. either, which is, troubling. And at the same time, it's gotten over $197 million in subsidies from state governments in the United States, from taxpayers, while all this is going on, and they're investing in another economy at the expense of the U.S. economy. Another example is Intel, which has shed several thousands of workers in the United States recently, but they just announced that they're going to invest $11 billion in a new factory in Israel. And just 2 months after they made that announcement, they announced a new round of layoffs in the United States. And this has actually been a trend for Intel over the past probably decade, I would argue. And over this same time frame, while this has been going on, they've gotten $25 million in subsidies. And the fact that Donald Trump continues to claim that he is America first, and in the past has sort of tried to pressure companies from outsourcing, he hasn't been doing that here. And it's important to ask why.
Whitney Webb, how neocon billionaire Paul Singer is driving the outsourcing of U.S. tech jobs to Israel. MintPressNews.com is where you go to find it. It's a fabulous, fabulous piece. Thank you so much for joining us and your contribution to The Critical Hour. Folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened, and I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.